Welcome to Nightlights. This is David Brent Johnson, and for the next hour, we'll be playing music from the heyday of the Los Angeles jazz scene and speaking with LA jazz historian Steve Aswardi. It's Come On Down to Central Avenue, coming up on this edition of Nightlights. Roy Porter's 1948 Los Angeles big band doing Sippin' with Cisco. Once upon a time, there was a place in Los Angeles known as Central Avenue. It's still there today, but what Central Avenue means today is very different from what it meant in 1940 or 1950. Jazz writer Ted Gioia calls the avenue of days gone by an elongated Harlem set down by the Pacific. Musical alumni of the illustrious Central Avenue scene included Dexter Gordon, Charles Mingus, Eric Dolphy, Art Farmer, Gerald Wilson, Lionel Hampton, Horace Tapscott, Art Pepper, Johnny Otis, and many more. Central Avenue was more than just a music scene, however. It was an entire cultural world. Jazz historian Steve Aswardi.
Central Avenue is crucial to not only the development of African-American culture in Los Angeles, but to the development of the African-American community in Los Angeles. It really was the center during the first half of the 20th century of the African-American community. Los Angeles was a very segregated city. From about beginning at about the turn of the 20th century up through the late 40s, early 1950s, and that segregation was maintained through racially restrictive housing covenants. Those were not struck down by the Supreme Court until late 40s, early 50s. So if you were African American in L.A. then, you pretty much had to live along Central Avenue. There was another area, smaller area west of it, where wealthier African Americans could live. But for 70-80% of the population, that's where you would have to be. So it was the social, the economic, and the cultural center of the community. It's an area that stretched from downtown Los Angeles, south about 4 or 5 miles to Slauson Boulevard. Then it jumped about 40 blocks of militantly defended white housing to the Watts area. And within that space, as far as culture and especially the music is concerned, it was a situation where you had block after block of clubs, theaters, restaurants, performance spaces. I mean, it was just a culturally, it was quite an extraordinary place. It was very alive. Decade after decade during that time, you could hear pretty much all types of black music. So it was very essential to the African-American community. It really, in a way, in the first half of the century, defined the African-American community.
Jazz historian Steve Aswardi on the world of Central Avenue. Though most of the music in this program will come from the 1940s and post-World War II era, Central Avenue had a thriving music scene in the 1920s and 30s as well. Pianist Jelly Roll Morton and trombonist Kid Ory were just two of the artists who figure in its early musical history. And then there were other bands, such as Paul Howard's Quality Serenaders, that never made a big name for themselves, but who featured up-and-coming players who'd go on to great renown. Here are the Serenaders, including Lionel Hampton and future Ellingtonian Lawrence Brown, doing California Swing on Nightlights.
Thank you.
Paul Howard's Quality Serenaders doing California Swing from Jazz in California 1923 through 1930, with feature Ellingtonian Lawrence Brown on trombone, Lionel Hampton on drums and vocals, and clarinetist, alto saxophonist, and future Los Angeles jazz educator Lloyd Reese in the band as well. It wasn't just the L.A. folks who made Central Avenue such a vibrant scene. Throughout the 1930s and 1940s, a number of jazz luminaries would make significant stops in Los Angeles and the Central Avenue environs, including pianist Art Tatum, who often lit up the main stem with his keyboard brilliance whenever he was in town, and Nat King Cole, who forged much of his musical identity during his time there. In 1941, Duke Ellington spent many months in L.A. playing at the Casa Manana and working on, then performing, his too-hip-for-its-time musical Jump for Joy. And in December of 1945, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie swooped into Billy Berg's club, trailing clouds of bebop glory behind them, their revolutionary sound winning them instant disciples among Central Avenue youths such as Sonny Chris and Hampton Hawes. But even before that, bebop had begun to be heard on the Avenue through a group led by trumpeter Howard McGee at the Downbeat Club, featuring Teddy Edwards on tenor saxophone. Here's a studio version of that group doing Dilated Pupils on Nightlights. Trumpeter Howard McGee performing Dilated Pupils with Teddy Edwards on tenor sax, Dodo Marmarosa on piano, Arvin Garrison on guitar, Bob Kesterton on bass, and Roy Porter on drums, recorded in the fall of 1946. Let's go for a stroll down Central Avenue circa 1945 with Los Angeles jazz historian Steve Aswardi.
Walking down the avenue, you could start downtown. You would go by 12th and Central, which was the center of the community, the cultural community, certainly in the 19s and the 1920s, and there would still be some clubs left there. If you continued further down, you'd pass by the Lincoln Theater at 23rd and Central, which was built in 1926, a large theater that featured a variety of acts and entertainments, from big bands to dancers, to tap dancers, to comedians, etc. If you carried down, you might go by the Florence Mills Theater, the Bird in the Basket, which was a place for jazz jam sessions. You might go by the Elks Hall near 40th and Central, which had three different performance venues. The large was a large auditorium where big bands perform regularly. And as you got down to 43rd and Central, that would be the heart of Central at that time. The Club Alabama was there, and next to the Club Alabama was the Dunbar Hotel, which was a four-story, 100-room hotel that opened in the late 20s. It was built by a man named John Somerville, a dentist, and he did such a thing because blacks had nowhere to stay that he thought represented fine accommodations, and it really was the finest hotel for African Americans in the country. Also on that same block, you would have the Downbeat Club at the other end of the block, which was by the 40s, was featuring some bebop. Across the street was The Last Word, another club that Johnny Otis would play at and Rhythm and Blues would be launched from. And then if you walked a few more blocks down, near Vernon and Central, you'd find some many more clubs. You'd pass by the Mimo Club. By the time you got to Vernon, if you walked just around the corner, you might find Ivy's Chicken Shack. Ivy Anderson, who sang with Duke Ellington, had opened that. And you'd find a little place also around that corner called Lovejoy's. You'd take a stairway up to the second floor, and there would be this funky little after-hours club where people just came to jam and hang out when the other places, the more formal places, closed down. And if you were lucky on some nights and Art Tatum was in town, he'd invariably come by and sit in and jam. The word was that when you saw Art's drummer, young drummer Bill Douglas, showing up with a case of Pabst, then you knew Art wasn't far behind. And you might bump into people hanging out at Lovejoy's, any of the great musicians on the scene, as well as people like Ava Gardner or Humphrey Bogart, etc. Hollywood certainly spent their time there. And then by the time you got down to Slauson, just around 56th, you wouldn't go past that. That was white territory for another 40 blocks.
Jazz historian Steve Aswardi giving us a walk back through time along Central Avenue in 1945. Lionel Hampton and Nat King Cole's trio providing the musical backdrop with Central Avenue Breakdown. Despite the rigid racial stratifications of Los Angeles in the 1940s, a number of white music fans and white celebrities did make their way to the Avenue. A few of the performers, in turn, were able to make forays into the posh clubs of Hollywood and find a following there. Among them were pianist singers Nellie Lutcher and Hoda Brooks, who appeared in several movies as a club performer, most notably Humphrey Bogart's 1950 noir film In a Lonely Place. Here she is performing That's My Desire on Nightlights.
To spend one night with you, be it all right. To reminisce with you, that's my desire. To dance where gypsies play and let our hearts hold sway down in that dim cafe. That's my desire. To sip a little glass of wine, to feel the thrill of your kiss while pressing your lips real close to mine, to hear you whisper low just when it's time to go. Darling, I love you so. That's my just when it's time to go. darling, I love you so. That's my desire.
Pianist and singer Hada Brooks performing That's My Desire, recorded in 1947. Brooks was also famous for her boogie-woogie piano recordings, such as Swingin' the Boogie. All sorts of musical styles were in vogue or coming into vogue along Central Avenue in the mid-1940s. Historian Steve Aswardi on one such development.
Rhythm and blues is starting to emerge as well. And by the end of 1945, Roy Milton goes in and records R.M. Blues, which in a way serves to launch much of the rhythm and blues movement. So you could go across the street from the Downbeat Club to the Last Word, and you could maybe hear the very beginnings of rhythm and blues as well.
Roy Milton and his Solid Senders doing R.M. Blues, recorded in January of 1945, just a few months before the end of World War II, a conflict that shaped and reshaped the avenue in a number of ways. Historian Steve Aswardi.
Well, the war had a tremendous impact on Central Avenue in a lot of different ways. Certainly one is population-wise. The demographics really jump. Many, many people, and not only African-Americans, but from throughout the country, are coming to California, and especially Southern California, for work in the war industries. A substantial percentage of wartime production is being done in Southern California. So as well as existing plants being converted, new plants being built, so there's a demand for labor. And that had a huge attraction to African Americans, especially from the South, Southwest. So that was one impact. Another, of course, was with this influx of people and with relatively more money in people's pockets during the war, because there weren't as many consumer goods. With wartime production, you weren't going to go out and buy clothes washers and things like this. They just weren't available. So there was more cash in people's pockets, and one of the ways they could spend it was in entertainment. So the club scene along Central, which had been vibrant, you know, going back to World War I, really takes off during World War II. There are a lot of people working, a lot of women in the plants, people looking to relax, et cetera, after work. And so the Avenue really does expand that way. In one way, though it does decline, a lot of musicians are drafted. They're in the military. A lot of them are in military bands. But there is a drain on musicians who leave the Central Avenue area. You could say, in a way, it does open up opportunities for younger musicians, for women musicians, etc. But that's another change that does happen then.
Gerald Wilson leading his Los Angeles big band in a performance of Cruisin' with Cab, recorded in 1946 when Central Avenue was still going strong in the wake of World War II. We'll have more music from the heyday of Los Angeles' Central Avenue and more from our interview with L.A. jazz historian Steve Aswardi in just a few moments. Production support comes from the Laughing Planet Cafe and Soma Coffee House, offering San Francisco-style burritos, coffee drinks, fresh juices, and 100% fruit smoothies, and including locally grown and organic ingredients on the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington, Indiana. This is David Brent Johnson, and you're listening to Come On Down to Central Avenue on Nightlights.
Thank you.
playing music from the Central Avenue era of Los Angeles jazz on this edition of Nightlights, along with some reflections from jazz historian Steve Aswardi, who helped edit the oral history Central Avenue Sounds and to produce the box set that accompanied its publication. African-American high school music teachers played an important part in the education of Central Avenue's young jazz artists, just as they did in many other cities around the country, such as Chicago, Indianapolis, and Detroit. In some ways, these teachers are the unsung heroes of 20th century American jazz. Steve Aswardi on two Los Angeles teachers of note.
In Los Angeles, there were some very important people. Within the schools, especially, there was preeminent Samuel Brown at Jefferson High School. And Samuel Brown was there for almost 25 years. He created just a model program in terms of jazz education and just inspired a couple of generations of people who became just wonderful artists like Dexter Gordon and Charles Mingus, Buddy Collette, Horace Tapscott, many, many others, Art Farmer, you know, the list goes on, who really came under his tutelage and his mentoring and his just wonderful, wonderful influence. And then you had other teachers like Lloyd Reese, who was a legendary figure in Los Angeles during these decades. Private teacher, a professional musician, and a private teacher, and virtually anyone of any talent or anyone who was serious about the music went to study with Lloyd Reese. Samuel Brown would refer students to Lloyd when he thought they were ready. And everyone went through Lloyd Reese. He had a rehearsal band every Sunday morning at the Black Musicians Union on Central Avenue. And everyone played in it, from Mingus to Dexter Gordon to Horace to, you know, the range of artists, Mingus, etc.
There was another way young L.A. jazz musicians learned their trade, the same way their colleagues did all over the country. Central Avenue jazz veteran Buddy Collette.
But there were jam sessions all over the city. You know, you'd run to another spot if Tatum was in town. And earlier than that, you know, like when people like were living like Charlie Christian, the word would be out. And you'd just go from one place. There was a place called the Jungle Room, across the street from the Lincoln Theater. And guys would have them at their houses, you know. And like I said, it was hard to keep up with them all because you'd get your favorite people. And like I said, whether it was with Mingus or maybe Chico Hamilton would be somewhere and you'd go by his place and jam. And there was Lorenzo Flannoy who had a trio. You go to his spot. Red Calendar had a group. So sure, if you'd hear Dex or if you'd hear all those guys, which we didn't mention, okay, he was there. Somebody would have a story that took it someplace else because we were all being creative at this point. There were nights when Dexter and Wardell would be jamming for a month straight almost someplace. They'd meet up like two fighters.
Thank you.
tenor saxophonist Dexter Gordon and tenor saxophonist Wardell Gray doing The Chase, recorded in 1947 with Jimmy Bunn on piano, Red Callender on bass, and Chuck Thompson on drums. In addition to jam sessions, there were groups, some of which never recorded, that rehearsed and played with more formal ambitions on a regular basis. The Stars of Swing, featuring musicians such as tenor saxophonist Lucky Thompson, saxophonist Buddy Collette, and bassist Charles Mingus, was one such group. Several recordings made by a Mingus-led group minus Thompson are said to approximate the sound of this band, Buddy Collette.
If you can realize what is happening in this period, there's a bop thing coming in. It's like when the rock came in, the bass players didn't want to play Fender right away. But I'm saying, so the bop is coming in. I'm not really playing that much bop. I meet Parker, and of course your ideas change. But at this period, we wanted to play music that you could... It wasn't a Galambardo type of thing, but it was a pretty stuff. There was a lot of ballads, you know. I wrote a thing on I Remember April. It was a bop line later on, but it was a smooth line. See, so our concept was musical with the four-part voicing, and Dizzy and Burden then weren't doing that.
Group led by bassist Charles Mingus, the group very close in formation to the legendary Stars of Swing group, performing Bedspread. Many of the African Americans who lived in the Central Avenue area had moved there from Louisiana, Oklahoma, and Texas in search of better jobs, in search of better lives in general. One such cross-country immigrant was Texan Charles Brown, the pianist and singer who had such a huge hit with Driftin' Blues as part of Johnny Moore's Three Blazers, and who then forged a successful solo career for himself. Brown was a purveyor of what came to be known as club blues, a laid-back Nat King Cole-influenced idiom that captured a post-war sense of depression and alienation, and that also appeared
appealed to white Hollywood audiences. Here's his 1950 recording of Black Night on Nightlights.
Nobody cares about me. Ain't even got a friend. Baby's gone and left me. When will my troubles end? Black night is falling. Oh, I hate to be alone. I keep crying for my baby, but not another day is gone. I've got no one to talk with, to tell my troubles to. Don't even know I'm living since I lost you. Black night is falling. Oh, I hate to be alone. I keep crying for my baby, but not another day is gone.
Pianist and singer Charles Brown in 1950 doing Black Night, Maxwell Davis, the tenor saxophonist, accompanying him. We mentioned in the first half of the show that another new kind of music had begun to emerge in the post-war years along Central Avenue and elsewhere, rhythm and blues, which would also lead to the rise of rock and roll, a musical form that would eventually cast a huge shadow over the jazz world. Some saxophonists straddled the boundaries of several genres at once, or embraced the so-called honking and squealing school of playing. One saxophone hero of the time was Big J. McNeely, heard here in a live broadcast from the Olympic Auditorium in downtown Los Angeles, performing before an integrated audience.
And we're going to rock here till 2 o'clock in the morning. Get on down here to the Olympic Auditorium at 18th and Grand. And now, one of the stars of the evening, one of the men you've been waiting to hear blow, and it's the man that blows that deacon's harp, Big J. McNeely! Big J!
Thank you.
but time has run out on us. We're broadcasting from the ring at the Olympic Auditorium at 18th and Grand. Heard every Saturday night at 12 midnight. We'll be going till 2 o'clock in the morning, so come on down and join all the gang. We'll see you at the Olympic Auditorium every Saturday night.
Tenor saxophonist Big J. McNeely with a live broadcast performance of Deacon's Hop from the Olympic Auditorium in downtown Los Angeles in 1951. A number of divisive issues and problems bore down on the Central Avenue area in the 1950s. In the black musical community, one such issue was whether or not to push for the integration of the two musicians' unions, one having been created for black artists, the other for whites. Central Avenue jazz musician Buddy Collette.
In Los Angeles, we had two musicians' unions. One was Local 767, which was a black union, and the white union was Local 47. Now, when we came back from the service, I figured with my friends Mingus, Charles Mingus, and Britt Woodman, that we would try to make this one union. We didn't know how to do this, but we knew it wasn't right this way, even though certain people had accepted it. And the only thing that we didn't like was that if a white musician wanted to join Local 767, they couldn't, because the officials there would say, you have to go with the 47 and vice versa, see. So we knew something's wrong with this, because the musicians were working together in the bands, but you couldn't belong. And the scales were different, the work dues was different, and it was a double standard going on.
The so-called amalgamation issue divided the African-American musician community. Some African-American artists wanted to retain their own union. Ultimately, the two unions did merge. It's one of the painful paradoxes of black cultural history that the leap forward of integration proved, in some ways, detrimental to the cohesiveness of the African-American community, not only in Los Angeles, but in many other cities as well. In the decades following World War II and its immediate aftermath, Central Avenue would undergo an inexorable decline. Historian Steve Aswardi on some of the reasons why.
Well, the physical decline of Central certainly came about because of the Watts upheaval of 65. That was like the period at the end of the sentence. But really, from what I understand, from what my research suggests, and what most of the musicians told me that I interviewed, it really starts declining in the early 50s in other ways. Why? Generally, there are two reasons that stand out. One is certainly the striking down by the Supreme Court in a number of cases, beginning with Shelley versus Kramer in 48, and then a couple of other cases in the early 50s, striking down racially restrictive housing covenants, which meant that people in L.A. could live wherever they wanted to live, and certainly people along Central Avenue. By this time, it had become very crowded. Overcrowded in part, and people were looking to move, and those who could afford it started moving away from Central, and they moved west primarily and south of Central. So you could say, in one sense, certainly integration leads to that. Within just a couple of years, by the early 50s even, you could say that Western Avenue, a few miles west of Central Avenue, was becoming the center of the black community. Another reason that people point to quite a bit was the appointment of William Parker as chief of police in 1950. Parker was pretty much a virulent white supremacist, and he absolutely abhorred the race mixing on Central Avenue, because by night, during that first half of the 20th century, it was probably the only integrated part of Los Angeles where everybody would come from throughout LA for the music, for the culture, for the activity, the social scene. Well, this really bothered Parker, and almost as soon, not that, you know, it wasn't heavy on the part of the LAPD earlier, but it becomes especially heavy under Parker, and his troops, I guess you'd have to call them that, really attempt to break up the race mixing, as he called it, to drive away white patronage from Los Angeles. People would be routinely warned off. Whites would be routinely told that this was a dangerous area. They should stay away. Things such as this. At one point, they even set up in front of a popular record store. It's called Dolphins of Hollywood, but it was on just off Central. And the police were turning away white customers, saying, you don't belong down here. It's a dangerous area, et cetera, et cetera. So this campaign, certainly many people think, also affected Central Avenue because the white patronage was important for the economy of a lot of the clubs.
Jazz historian Steve Aswardi with Charles Mingus's Pipe Dream providing a musical accompaniment. Several books have appeared in the last few years about Central Avenue, perhaps most importantly the oral history Central Avenue Sounds, in which the musicians themselves remember and retell the era. The neighborhood today is in transition, with few physical reminders of what it once was. To those who read about it, it can seem as magical and distant a place as something out of Arabian Nights. To those who live there now, a trip to the avenue will leave one looking in vain for the signs of legend. Are these rubble-strewn lots? Are these boarded-up buildings and empty streets where Charlie Parker once held court? Where young Dexter Gordon once walked? Where teenage Charles Mingus began to find his musical genius? And even those who actually lived in those times later found themselves in a state of dislocation when they returned many years later. Steve Aswardi.
I remember when I interviewed a great, great trumpeter and person, Art Farmer, for the Central Avenue Project. Art had been away since the 50s. He'd never gone back down there. And just before our interview, he was in town to play a week at Catalina's Bar and Grill. And just before our interview, he rented a car and drove back to Jefferson High School and down the avenue to his old haunts from the late 40s, early 50s. He wanted to kind of jog his memory before he sat down with a tape recorder. And when I got together with him, he told me this, and you could see he was still depressed about it. And there's a moving bit in Central Avenue Sounds. I put it in there where he says, you know, how depressing it was. He said to go back there and to see absolutely nothing left from what he remembered and how wonderful those memories were. And he said, you know, it makes you wonder whether it was all just a dream, an illusion, whether it ever really happened.
Buddy Collette Quartet in 1948 doing Collette from the box set Central Avenue Sounds. ¶¶ Thanks for tuning into this edition of Nightlights. Special thanks to Steve Aswardi. You can listen to this and previous Nightlights programs and new playlist on our website at nightlights.indiana.edu. Nightlights is engineered by Michael Paskash and produced in the studios of WFIU at Indiana University. This is David Brent Johnson, wishing you good listening for the week ahead.